289, in this little volume that you see here, and according to the preface, consisted of a series of fragments which H. P. Blavatsky had memorized from a much larger collection of esoteric facts and precepts, which he refers to as the Book of the Golden Precepts. This particular copy, by the way, is inscribed to Miss Anna Ballard to help her to become a Yogini, from her affectionately, H. P. Blavatsky, London, 1889. Therefore, this is as authentic an edition of the book as we can really expect to find. And it contains not only the three sections relating to the journey toward enlightenment, but the commentaries and glossaries at the back describing the use of oriental terms. I think the first point that comes to our thoughtfulness in connection with this book is that it is by far the most evidential in the matter of indicating H. P. Blavatsky's knowledge of Mahayana Buddhism. In this particular little volume, she clearly indicates not only her familiarity with this particular school of Buddhist thought, but her strong addiction to the thinking of the Northern School. In other words, the entire study as contained in this little treatise has to do with the Bodhisattva concept, which we have discussed here on other occasions, but which perhaps it would be advantageous to summarize once more. Buddhism divides into two basic schools. The southern, or the school of the elders, called the Hinayana, and the northern, or the Mahayana, the great vehicle. There was originally a middle vehicle between these two, but it did not gain any lasting prominence in Asiatic religious thinking. The Southern School has as its basic project, or its great goal, the creation of the arhat, the creation of the unworldly person who has renounced all of the material associations of life, who has rejected involvement in the mystery of existence, and has determined to attain by will and yoga the emancipation, which is covered by the concept of the entry into nirvana. In other words, the Southern School seeks to end all suffering by extinguishing the individual himself. But it is conceivably possible for man to kill out within himself, degree by degree, the essence of his own individuality. That in so doing, he has discovered the only escape from illusion, inasmuch as he is bound to illusion by every concrete faculty of his own mind and every emotion of his own heart. Once in the Southern School, theoretically at least, we have this complete renunciation of all attachment, the resolution to attain the solitary path of liberation, to become not only the truth seeker, but the truth finder. Not through the common experiences of life, but by the rejection of life. This does not mean that the arhat is to become a destructive person. He is not one who is rejecting society in an anarchistic way. He is not trying to rugedly create a new kind of society. He is simply rejecting all worldliness. And he is not attempting to put in the place of illusion any tangible, physical, material, objective reality which he may experience or discover. This particular point of view, of course, was what we might term archaic. It is assumed to represent very completely the teachings of the oldest sacred writings of Buddhism. Yet, as we mentioned on another evening, the concept, though upheld by the scripture, is not upheld by the example of Gautama Buddha himself. Far from renouncing all association with humanity, he devoted the greater part of his life to the continuous service of his fellow men. Certainly there is no evidence that he withheld from those around him any knowledge, consolation, insight, or understanding which could contribute to their enlightenment. Therefore, the life of the Buddha cannot be regarded as an example of the dicta of the Southern School. In the particular book we are working with, The Voice of the Silence, H.P. Blavatsky criticizes, through the translation of old fragments of the Northern system, this attitude of complete rejection of life. She is not in favor, obviously, of the solitary journey toward reality. She does not believe that it is the highest form of life, highest destiny of the human being, to become absorbed into a non-existence with no consideration for other human beings. Of course, this was the primary point of demarcation in the very early time, which led to the mysticism of Nagarjuna. And according to H.P.B., the Book of the Golden Precepts was part of the wonderful storehouse of esoteric knowledge guarded by the Vedas in the Iron Tower in India, the mysterious repository of the esoteric doctrine of Buddhism. So in this book, we see Madame Blavatsky outlining from memory and from fragments that she had learned and contacted, notes she had made various times during her long sojourn in India, putting together this little guide or book of rules for the direction of the sincere truth seeker. There is actually no effort to westernize the basic concepts. Madame Blavatsky assumes in this book, obviously, that there is no essential transformation of material to meet the needs of Western people, so far as the great quest is concerned. East and West must follow the same path. There is no adaptation to the requirements of Western thinking. There is, however, this one very strong sympathetic tie with the West. The concept of unselfishness, the concept of man seeking to attain truth without this lonely, self-centered dedication to some type of oriental discipline. Out of the Buddhist texts themselves, there can only be one other clear statement of the path, and that is the Northern School. And Madame Blavatsky, following also the Buddhist position almost exactly, refers to this school as the heart doctrine and the Southern School as the eye doctrine. The eye, in other words, in this case, refers to the power of vision, the optical sense. or the concept of the exoteric, which sees the external only, represented by the eye, as contrasted to the esoteric, which experiences from within, the heart doctrine, knowing with the heart, following the heart, setting up the tabernacle of hope in the heart rather than in the mind. Perhaps it is in this segregation or separation that we come the nearest to the east-west position. Actually, in Ceylon and other areas under the influence of the Hinayana, what Madame Blavatsky calls the I doctrine, we must realize that the average Buddhist is a very kindly person by instinct. Men are often much more kind than their beliefs. And we find that even now in our Western religion, where faiths which have a considerable streak of intolerance in them are served by very kindly, tolerant people who never realize their beliefs are more stony, more cold or stony than the ordinary concepts might suggest. So we do not necessarily find people always following the letter of an ancient belief. Today we know that in Burma and in Ceylon and in Thailand or Siam, Buddhism is a very warm belief, in spite of the fact it belongs to the Southern school. The only real difference between the two systems in modern practice, the only practical difference, so far as the average person is concerned, is that the Southern school clings more definitely to the imagery of the historical Buddha Gautama. Nearly all imagery in the Southern school is that of the historical Buddha. Buddha, his apostles or disciples, may sometimes also receive some imagery, but the only bodhisattva recognized in the Southern school is the Maitreya or Buddha to come. The other vast order of metaphysical beings find no place in the Southern system. Well, outside of this, we find the same general happiness of people. We do not find that this lonely road to extinction has led, for the most part, to lonely living in this world. The family life in these Buddhist countries is strong. The friendliness and relationships are gentle and, for the most part, kindly. So even in Southern Buddhism, while the creed remains very severe in its principles, it is served by people who are not especially severe in their own conduct. The great stronghold of Southern Buddhism today is not in Ceylon, Burma, or Ceylon. It is in Germany and England. But while, of course, the following is small in Europe, the modern European intellectual rather favors the intense detachment, the freedom from all theological involvements which have distinguished the Southern school of thought. It seems more rational in the sense of science. Science believes that when we are dead forever. And Southern Buddhism changes this into a final extinction as a result of outgrowing worldliness. But science and Southern Buddhism both seem to end in some kind of an extinction, therefore they more or less favor each other's points of view. The modern system, however, is more completely idealistic and more theological, therefore is not as popular with the German intellectuals. It is, to them, again, a compromise with the old superstitions which they feel they have outgrown. Madame Blavatsky very firmly takes the ground that the modern system represents the true custodian of the esoteric doctrine, that it is not merely a matter of the system that you use. It's possible that both the southern and the northern systems of Buddhism have both derived much of their esoteric discipline from Yoga and Vedanta, and from the early religions of India. Many of the quotations used by HPV in The Voice of the Silence are pre-Buddhistic, but have become involved in and become part of Buddhist thinking. Actually, however, as she points out, it is not just simply this orthodoxy, this dedication to development, to growth, to the inner ways of things, this renunciation of that which is illusional, mundane, or to the more mystical inclined, worldly. This is not the entire problem. The great problem lies in the warmth element, that the individual's motives have a tremendous part to play in his spiritual attainment. And to Madam Blavatsky, the motive of the individual searching for salvation for his own sake is not the highest motive. This, of course, leads to some controversy between the different systems. There can be no doubt that the Arhat system does produce the possibility of the individual attaining the nirvanic condition by a magnificent self-discipline, a renunciation of worldliness, and a final overcoming of all sensory processes and pressures within his own nature. However, this must indicate in some way that there is more than one kind of nirvana. There has to be more than one kind of end, because there are certainly several means by which this end can be attained. And from the general tone of the Voice of the Silence, it would be implied by H.P. Blavatsky that the Arhat seeking completely isolated attainment has in this very process itself fallen into a kind of illusion, that in so doing he is going to attain the end which he believes. If he believes that he will enter nirvana and cease to exist, he will carry this belief, but it will be an attitude rather than a fact. And when he attains this nirvana, which he believes, he will attain an internal state of his own existence, which, however, may not prove to be ultimate, may not attain the final consummation which he desires. It is quite possible that the individual who believes that after he leaves this life, he will go to a summer land with palaces and white-robed figures, may be able to evoke this picture within his own consciousness and actually believe that he attains it. If, on the other hand, he believes that this summer end is an illusion and that the only true end is a complete suspension of existence in a colorless, soundless, dimensionless sphere, he may, after death, find himself in such a region. But whether the region is any more real than the summer land of the spiritualist is another problem. And H.P. Blavatsky seems to imply that there is grave danger that this isolated truth seeker is going to end in a universe which he has created himself, rather than in the infinite which he has expected to attain. In any event, she leaves a strong sense that there is something wrong with this tremendous search for liberation. It is quite possible that the being may attain that condition of the taking upon itself of the Dhammakaya, or the body of infinites, so that this being, this I-hat being, who has renounced all existence, may so sever all connections with material existence that it cannot return. when it cannot take on again any of the conditions of existence. But then comes the question, under these circumstances, will this being find peace or loneliness? Will it really have outgrown the world in the purest sense, or will it merely have separated itself from the world, perhaps to wistfully look back sometime upon a condition which is no longer changeable by any action of its own? But in any event, Blavatsky certainly favors and gives greater consideration to the concept of the Bodhisattva atonement. I think that one point that we also have to bear in mind, however, is that she differs from the Northern school also in one particular. The Orthodox Mahayanist regards the Bodhisattvas as essentially symbolic extensions of the powers of the historical Buddha. In other words, all the metaphysical Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are personifications of principles. They are not regarded as beings. They are not held to be true persons. Rather, they are ideal types. And in this, the Northern school has a tendency to create a curious kind of theology without gods. A theology which Dr. Anasaki calls a cosmotheism. A system in which embodied principles take the place of personalities. Martin Blavatsky, on the other hand, thinks much more literally in terms of the Bodhisattva concept. She takes the Lotus of the Good Law, the great Lotus Sutra of Northern Buddhism, and in the stories of the attainments of the Bodhisattvas, she takes it much more for granted that the average truth seeker is ultimately going to attain the Bodhisattva condition, and therefore that the Bodhisattvas are true beings, representing a degree of evolvement from mankind itself. That they are therefore not merely personifications of principles. They are dedicated, illumined persons who have attained to a stupendous degree of internal insight. They are demigods or superhuman beings, but they are beings as such. They are not merely personifications of principles. Now, I think in this particular point, we probably will have to make a division between these embodied principles and the possible involvement of human beings to the Bodhisattva state. This has been suggested in dividing the rebels to allow for two kinds of Bodhisattvas. One kind being eternal, being truly the embodiments of the various cosmic energies arising from the great source of all energy, the eternal, luminous, unconditioned, unchanging Vira Karmadura. From this vast cosmic being flow forth the attributes and conditions, as in the case of light coming from the sun. The light itself breaks into colors like a spectrum, and to each of the colors of this light a name is given. And to one of these colors is given the name Kanman. To another one of these colors, Manju. To a third, Fugan. To still another, Miroku. They represent essentially the colors of the infinite light of truth itself, they represent division within energy, by which energy is qualified, and by being so qualified becomes available to maintain the various orders of life that exist in nature. Light sustains all life, and light itself is a manifestation of an infinite life. And this infinite life is Virakana, by reaching your eye. The human bodhisattvas, those who are growing up from nature, from the human state to the superhuman state, ascend along the paths of light, which are indicated or intimated in the book, The Voice of the Silence. Each of these ascending beings, human beings at one time, less than human at another, more than human at still another, these belong to rays. They belong to, in some mysterious way, to orders of life. From light, they have their origin. But we have all originated from some color of the light. Therefore, our own psychic integration belongs to one of these rays. And we gradually attain our enlightenment by ascending to truth along the paths of light which are peculiar to ourselves. Therefore, we can use an example which perhaps will indicate the general thinking. The Bodhisattva Kanban, representing the eternal, luminous principle of compassion. HBB points out clearly that in her thinking, Avalokita, or Kanban, is not an attribute, but an eternal principle in itself. Compassion is not simply a quality of mercy that is not strained. Compassion is a color of the eternal light of space itself. These wonderful virtues, therefore, have a pre-existence as light, as energy, as substance. Therefore, perhaps they correspond at least partly to the Greek idea of the eternal gods. But they are actually the eternal colors in the white light. They are the mysterious spectrum of eternal energies. Therefore, the principle of compassion is of itself a living thing, an attribute of existence. And there are those who, in truth seeking, are inevitably drawn to this particular light color. Just as some will say, I prefer blue to green, and another will say, I prefer brown to orange, so we can say in ourselves that we have certain spiritual preferences. These preferences are not at the exclusion of other virtues or other values, but they are by nature instincts of our own. Just as some may be more instinctively drawn to music, and others perhaps to painting. Some find their fulfillment in bestowing their love and their lives upon their children. Some seek rather a public service, whereby they become parents of mankind. Each in his own way, according to his own inner dedication, according to the role to which he belongs, instinctively reacts a little more intensely, a little more clearly, to one type of this light power. If, therefore, the individual who is seeking attainment is resolved to dedicate a life to service, to become the compassionate power, almost trying to assume in itself the burden of the sin of the world, the all-understanding one, the all-comprehending, the all-sympathizing, that which is moved by all sorrow, the large, mysterious Bodhisattva ear indicating the power to hear the cry of the smallest creature floating in the sunbeam, so that there is not a single breath of life or death in space that the ear of the compassionate one does not hear it. This inclines certain persons to this way of life, and they ascend the path that leads to the stars by approaching the heart of that quality which is most admirable to them. So we have the common quality. Then we may have another quality also, as represented by the Bodhisattva Manju. Manju is the one that is referred to in the Lotus Sutra as a young man of good family, a prince of the heavenly world. Manju represents essential learning, learning that transcends knowledge, learning that submerges self in the complete acceptance of universal truth. Just as surely as compassion leads to universal insight and universal love, so learning leads to universal wisdom, and most of all in learning, universal obedience. Therefore, Manju represents knowledge regenerated, redeemed, purified, spiritualized, until it becomes the perfect attainment leading to the salvation of all that lives through the complete acceptance of laws that have come to be known and understood. Thus, each of these ray colors draws to itself from humanity those of special attribute or ability, and through the long systems of embodiments through which individuals pass, it becomes obvious that gradually their own farther ray or farther star becomes obvious within them, and they begin the journey back to that color of the infinite life which gave them being in the first place. This is part of the idea of the Northern School. But the Northern School has as its tremendous goal the achievement of the serving Bodhisattva. Now, the Southern School takes the ground that this is all useless. For actually, if you wish to take the sword of quick detachment, if you wish to destroy the destroyer, if you wish to assume that the mind is the slave of the will, then we must finally assume that law is infinite, and that mercy and wisdom and all of these others, these qualities, are only man's images of perfections arising within his own nature. Some of the Buddhist sects of today in the Northern School frankly affirm this to be true. But Blavatsky's point of view is a little different than this. Whether the problem implies that the Bodhisattva is merely a symbol of the natural humanitarianism in man, or whether it is truly part of this great fabric that sustains the universal plan, the great truth remains. The mysterious virtue in this growth of the human consciousness resulting from dedication to unselfishness. That instead of killing out the self, as in the Southern School, the self is expanded until it encloses all other things within its own nature. Instead of killing out love, universalize love. Instead of killing out desire, redeem desire, so that it may desire the salvation of all that lives. Take each of these faculties and instead of destroying it, expand it to its cosmic proportions. Perfect it. Redeem it. Vitalize it with life. Transmute it with the alchemy of insight. And gradually escape from the illusion of self, not by destroying self, but by so enlarging it that all that exists becomes part of self. By this means, you achieve in a strange way almost the same goal. For it is too difficult to tell in practice the difference between the individual whose being has returned to the infinite and the individual whose being has become infinite by virtue of its own internal enlargement. So in the path of the golden precepts, as contained in Madame Blavatsky's outline, the primary dedication of the truth seeker must be essentially unselfish. It must be a dedication to the good of all that lives. And only by this dedication can the mysterious bypaths that lead to darkness be completely and entirely escaped. The unselfishness now takes the position which assumes the proportions of a total investment of self in the need of other creatures. Learning is no longer because it will give us knowledge, but because through it we can impart knowledge to all that lives. The individual, therefore, has to avoid the primary obstacles to spiritual growth. And here, I think, Madame Blavatsky was speaking to the members of the U.S. section and was also trying to bring home to Western scholars, Western students, something of the moral value of decision in terms of truth-seeking. It is not enough for an individual to take an obligation that he is going to search for truth, nor is it enough for him to train his mind, integrate his faculties, and resolve to continue his search until truth rewards him. The only important consideration from the beginning is motive. Why does the individual wish to attain the truth? If he says he wishes to obtain it because it will deliver him from evil, the motive is good but not the best. If he says that he wishes to obtain it in order to escape from the suffering of the world, this motive is not as good as the previous one. The individual who wishes to attain wisdom in order that he may gain some advantage over an ignorant world has the lowest motive there is. And because of the lowness of the motive, the end can never be high. Built into the pattern, the plan, the search we are making, is the outcome of it karmically in the terms of the motive that impelled it. Man can never attain more than the level of principle upon which he began the search. Of course, it is conceivable that he may gradually change his attitude and move from selfishness to a more unselfish position. But Madame Blavatsky would imply that this is not a desirable state of affairs, because the final motive must ultimately reassert itself. And if we began in selfishness, we still have built bad karma, which we must sometime expiate, and which will sometime confront us with the inevitable consequence of karma. All karma leads the individual to mistake a wrong for a right. All karma leads in some way to the acceptance of the reality of the unreal. This is illusion. And wrong motive must always lead to some kind of illusion, because it cannot lead to truth. Now, some will hold that it makes no difference what motive you have, and you are climbing a mountain, if you reach the top, you have attained the end. But in the mountains of the Himalayas, this is not true from the standpoint of the Mahayana school. Everything is motive. Everything is the basic determination which impels the action. So for the benefit of our Western chairs, H.P.B. points out the tremendously important problem of a right perspective at the very beginning of the search. Three things are necessary. right perspective, right resolution, and continuity or continuance of effort. Right perspective means that the individual has the true goal in sight, and that the end he is seeking is truth, not merely some consolation for himself in a selfish, self-centered emergency. Therefore, it is impossible for the individual to achieve the greater end by lesser dedication. Also, we realize that there can be no growth unless the individual who is attempting to grow practices the principles which are given to him by the Guru. To simplify this thinking, the Guru, in this case the Buddha, gave his disciples the simple laws: refrain from all evil, practice the good, purify the mind. These were the rules, the basic rules. Any effort to grow by compromising these rules or without enforcing them must ultimately lead to illusion. No matter how sincere the person is, unless he does purify the mind, unless he does refrain from evil, and unless he does practice the good, he cannot attain the karmic consequences of the keeping of the mystery of the three jewels, or the Triratna. So Buddhism says that any attempt to grow without keeping the law must ultimately lead to some kind of a strange paroxysm within the self, an infinite confusion, a strange fatalistic sickness, because we are torn apart by our own inconsistency. If we use disciplines and definite exercises to advance or to unfold the sensitivity of the psychic organism, and at the same time do not provide it with an enlightened mind, a purified emotional life, and a redeemed body, then the efforts to unfold the spiritual powers within the individual will destroy the economy of the mental, emotional, and physical personality. There cannot be this conflict without ultimate loss, a terrible loss, to all concerned. Thus, H.P.B. points out that it is very important to get into our basic consciousness this concept of growth not for ourselves, but for that which is not ourselves, and always the realization that we will not devote ourselves and dedicate ourselves to the service of others unless we have real love for them. And if we do not have real love for all that lives, it is better to turn from the gate and wait, because otherwise we're going to be in trouble. And that was one of the difficulties that arose in the HPB's own disciples. They tried to recognize growth as a scientific process. They put their minds to it with all they had, but they did not put their hearts to it with the fullness of compassion. When we realize the meaning of compassion, we immediately come almost to the same situation that has gradually come into focus about crime in our world. We are more and more convinced that criminals are not bad, they are sick. And this is one of the attitudes that we have to carry into the world of compassion. The people are not bad. They are confused. They are sick. The individuals are not evil. That is, they are followers of illusion. They have been caught up in an unreality. And in the service of this unreality, they have become selfish, hateful. They have injured each other. They have borne false witness. They have robbed and pillaged. They have done everything that it is imaginable to do, perhaps, to be of injury to others. Not because they are bad, but because they do not know what is right. They may have morally some concept of a code. They may know that they are dishonest, legally speaking. But in their consciousness, they have no vision of reality. Therefore, in their consciousness, they are benighted. They dwell in darkness. They are victims of illusion. They are slaves that have been brought into bondage by Mara, the Lord of deceits. So that the compassionate one is in no way a different mind when viewing the person who is kind and the person who is cruel. Compassion must reach them both equally. At the same time, without under any condition failing to sense the true values. But compassion is the realization that the person who is behaving the worst is the one who is in the greatest need for insight, love, understanding, sympathy, and compassion. And ways must be found to help this person so that the bodhisattva does not renounce nirvana in order to save his friends. He renounces nirvana to be of service to all that lives, whether it be good or bad. Without this complete dedication, there can never be escape from the processes of judgment. And the moment we judge, compassion dies. The moment we assume any of these prerogatives to ourselves, we are in danger. The only passion of which man can be proud is compassion. And this is the mood that opens the portals of the world of spiritual growth. So the purpose of evolution in the search for realities is to produce within each aspiring soul this tremendous sense of selfless dedication to need. But the modern school seeks to produce the type of esoteric disciple who no longer even cares whether he is ever enlightened or not. He is not seeking enlightenment. All he is asking for is a job. He is asking for the privilege of giving everything that he has, everything that he is, to those in need, without the slightest hope of appreciation, expectancy of appreciation, or even desire for reward. It is the total giving. And it is the individual who makes this total giving that is also implied in the Christian mystery, where Jesus says very frankly that those who lose their lives for his sake will find eternal life. It is the complete renunciation of self-purpose, the complete end of the desire to know for the sake of knowing anything. The individual doesn't learn to know so that he can face life better or death better. He learns to know in order that in complete forgetfulness of himself, he can help others to face life better and to face death better. His own fate is unimportant to him. Because in this way he loses his life by giving it up, so he shall find it again more abundantly. The motive is so essential in this that Madame Blavatsky makes a very clear point of it. That the motive is always the same. That the great path of enlightenment is the path of self-forgetfulness. The path of the complete power of the person to transcend the experience of being truly, greatly injured by anything. It is, he is no longer concerned with how much he is injured. He is only mindful that under no condition, for any reason, must he ever injure anything. Now, this makes a rather complicated life in the Western world. And for most people, it seems utterly impossible. And the great teachers of the Northern system, therefore, point out very clearly that the impossible is not expected. While we are not living in Tibet or Inner Mongolia, we must not forget that those countries have their problems just as we have. That it was never easy anywhere for the individual to live according to the very highest interpretation of the golden precepts. The individual had to live according to his insight. If he tried to live beyond and above his insight, he lost the support of his own nature. He might know within himself that he should do certain things. But if he is not able to do these things without too much strain, stress, and problem in his own life, he is then obviously not ready. When he is ready, he will find that the way will open, as the Red Sea opened for the Israelites. But when the time is right, when he becomes utterly harmless, nothing will harm him. And this was the secret of the old sages and the old Arhats of Buddhism, who wandered through jungles, and the animals guarded them. There are stories in the old books which are probably true, where the old sages were warned that there were dangerous animals in the neighborhood, like a ferocious tiger. So the old sage went out in the jungle, met the tiger, and they walked along side by side, and when the old sage went to sleep that night, the tiger gave his body for a pillow. There was no evil in the sage. There was in this enlightened being only love for all that lives. We know in the animal kingdom, we know from working with people who have in turn become what they call animal people, those who are able to train and control animals, that there are psychic sympathies between men and animals. And that if the animal knows the human being is right, its attitude is usually not dangerous. And there are many cases where animals of the most ferocious nature have fled to men to escape other dangers, sensing within themselves that the human being is some way capable of protecting them. So in the idea of the golden precept, in Northern Buddhism, emphasis has shifted, as will be found in nearly all of the ancient writings, from the concept of the nirvana as the ultimate to the establishment of a different concept of afterlife existence. The individual is still held by the bonds of rebirth and karma. He is still within a universe of absolute law. But as men in various professions can earn different wages, and each workman is worthy of his hire, so it is also that those workmen who are engaged in the building of the everlasting house receive their wages according to their merits. Some receiving the wages of those who carry water. Others receiving the wages of those who build. And still others, those who oversee the builders. So it is in the great experiences of spiritual maturity. Individuals attaining varying degrees of true achievement bring upon themselves appropriate karmic reactions Therefore, man may not only think of himself in his present state and in his ultimate state. He may think of himself in his transitional state, moving from his present degree of enlightenment to a greater and still greater degree. This was the concept behind the creation of the idea of the paradise of the Buddhas, such as Amitabha, or Virakara, or Hosa, or Shaka, any one of the great metaphysical Buddhas, or historical ones, who have built worlds in space to be the blessed abiding places of those who have been faithful to their teachings. So in the northern system, the individual is rewarded for doing the best that he knows. And his reward is to be released from that degree of evil which he has transmuted in himself to a corresponding degree of good. Thus, in the northern system, the householder, the shopkeeper, the businessman, all these and many others are perfectly able to attain the spiritual graces without renouncing their professions, without giving up their works, without leaving their homes and families. But the achievement is always according to motivation. And if the individual who is dedicated to the service of those responsibilities that he has assumed and serves them faithfully is just as spiritually unfolding as the person who renounces the world to go out on some solitary course of arhatship. Actually, therefore, the world itself becomes the great hall of initiation. The worldly problems become the steps which lead into the inner sanctuary of the mysteries. The Mahayana position in this case, I think, is very well taken. For instead of the yogas of the detached, renounced, unworldly person, now comes the more kindly yogas of the fulfillment of duty, the fulfillment of the needs of others. The unselfish parent is just as much a victor by renunciation as the person who walks out on all his attachments. The modern Buddhist does not believe in this walking out of anything. He believes in working through all things, and that in the course of embodiments, life after life, the individual has earned the right to finally achieve freedom, to devote his entire existence to a spiritual goal. When the time comes, he will earn this right and it will be given to him. But he must never anticipate his own right to walk out on that which is his present need. Never for one moment allow the advantage of self to impel the person to a deed that is not truly compassionate.